Well, we are so grateful to have with us this morning Rabbi Chase Foster from Congregation Beth Israel. And you probably have either heard or seen the senior rabbi there, Rabbi David Lyon, who's been here at St. Martin's multiple times. And Chase has been at your place for about 2 years now,
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, got here. Was that July 1st of 2017? I don't know. Yeah, wow, okay. 2017, right?
Great.
This is 19?
This is 19.
How what year we're
this
in?
Is 19. So will you please join me in welcoming Chase Foster?
Yeah. Thank you. I'm really honored to be here and grateful that all of you are willing to come out at this time of the morning. I know this is part of your ritual to be here at 7 o'clock in the morning on Thursday morning, but I'm grateful to be a part of it and to be here to speak a little bit about Judaism. So I'll start big picture with some things about Judaism, how many Jews there are, some of those types of sociological things, and then I'll kind of dive into a little bit about what is Judaism, some of Judaism's basic beliefs and tenets a little bit. I'll dive into different branches of Judaism. So just like in Christianity, there are Catholics and not Catholics, but many different branches of Christianity. The same thing is true in Judaism. And I'll talk a little bit and I'll show a video that kind of helps tell a little bit of that story. And then a few other tidbits. And then hopefully I'll leave. My goal is to leave around 10 to 15 minutes at the end for question and answer. Make sense? Ooh, I love it. And there is even response too. It's a lively crowd. I love it. So I'll start. Judaism is a tradition that we love our sacred texts, and I'll talk a little bit about what our sacred texts are in a moment, but I'll start with one. So Pirkei Avot, which is Mishnah, which is a second century text. So this is a text that was written in the first 150 or so years after the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem. And the Mishnah, which was then folded into the Talmud in those first few centuries, was the first rabbis. Rabbi wasn't a term that was used until around 2,000 years ago. It was the first rabbis' attempt to make sense of the world around them, the world in which they lived, which was a world without the temple and therefore a world without sacrifices. So before, when we had the time of the temples, between the time of the Exodus from Egypt, when they were our ancestors were wandering in the desert, that they had the tabernacle and they sacrificed there wherever they were. They moved into the land. Eventually, they built the temple in Jerusalem and were able to do sacrifices there in Jerusalem, and a few other outlying areas as well had a few places for those who weren't within a reasonable distance of Jerusalem. But then after the destruction of the Second Temple, it's a complete shift in Jewish life from this idea of sacrifice to whatever came next. And so this text is one of the first summations of trying to figure out what that is. And so the text, there's a Hebrew saying that we love. It's kind of a collection of Jewish wisdom, if you will. I'll tell you the Hebrew first, and then I'll translate it, because I assume most of you aren't Hebrew scholars. Al shlosha devarim ha'olam omed, al ha'torah ve'al ha'avodah ve'al gemilut chasadim. On three things the world stands. Al ha'torah, on Torah, when I'll talk a little about that. On avodah, which I will describe as sacred worship or sacred work, and al gemilut chasadim, on acts of loving kindness. So what's really amazing here is, so Torah, I'll talk a little bit more about Torah in a moment. Avodah, sacred worship or sacred work for all of us. Avodah in modern Hebrew literally means work. Like if you have a job, you're going to go do some avodah. But in terms of religious Jewish texts, avodah is talking about the sacred worship. So whether that is prayer, or whether that's turning the lights on or moving the chairs and tables or vacuuming after a great breakfast event or whatever that might be for you to consider your sacred work for you to do as a part of the community. And gimilu chasadim, acts of loving kindness, I think is pretty self-explanatory, at least as an ideal. But, and this is an important thing that I want to drive home, not all Jews believe the same thing. There's a joke that we have that two Jews, three opinions. And so directly after, a few verses later in this text, you have al shlosha devarim ha'olam omed, on three things the world stands, but you have a completely three separate things. Al din, on judgment, Al-Emet on truth, and Al-Shalom, which will be peace or can be sometimes construed as justice or used as justice in this moment. So what is Judaism? It's a little complicated. Our beliefs are complicated. If you were to ask me something, and so I'm going to try to explain things that, what do Jews believe? Well, I'll tell you some broad brushstrokes and then also tell you that not everyone will believe that. And I'll kind of sort of maybe highlight some of those things as I go along. So as some of this, I imagine you might know. So Judaism is one of the three major monotheistic religions, one of the Abrahamic faiths. So Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So part of that three-headed triumvirate of monotheistic religions that take up a big chunk of the world population and world belief system. It's more than just a religion, though. We consider ourselves a people, that there's an ethnicity or series of ethnicities that are inside of Judaism. I'll talk a little bit more later about how we got to some of that. We have customs and all sorts of things, our own food, if you will, and we really consider ourselves a people. There's this idea of Am Yisrael, of the people of Israel, and that when we think of things and we think of ourselves and we think of decisions that we make or potential. So I am a Reform Jew, which is the denomination, if you will, is Reform Judaism. And so when we make a reform, when we think of something that as we are trying to move in a certain way for whatever purpose, that is a thing that we need to take into consideration, is how we fit into this greater picture of Am Yisrael and how our decisions affect the rest of the Jewish people. And as a part of that with peoplehood, you can either be born a Jew or you can convert. But and depending upon who you ask, there are hard lines as to who is a Jew and how you can become a Jew. And so it's a process. And so that someone asked earlier in the line about if we basically hinted at if we have any, you know, fights over things or go to war over topics. I don't know if people necessarily, Jews will go to war against other Jews, but I said we definitely have war of words with each other for certain. So there are around 16 million Jews in the world right now, which is 0.2% of the world population. About a smidge under 7 million each here in America and in Israel, and then around 2 million spread throughout the rest of the world. Obviously, as you might imagine, the Holocaust and World War II changed those numbers and where people lived substantially. Estimated somewhere around 6 million is the number that most people use for the number of Jews who were killed in the Holocaust. We are finally back. Most sociologists believe that we have finally replenished that 6 million or just at that point of where the population was before Hitler's attempted genocide against the Jewish people. A little bit more about Houston, per se. There are 65,000, give or take, Jews in the Houston metro area, and that includes from the Woodlands and Clear Lake and Katy, et cetera, the really greater Houston. 65% of that 65,000 lives in a 3 to 4 mile radius of the Meyerland area, which is where Congregation Beth Israel is, between Hillcroft and Chimney Rock down on North Braeswood on Braes Bayou. So just about, depending on traffic, 15 minutes from here, give or take. So I said earlier that the world stands on Torah. So what is Torah? Torah scholars will call the Hebrew Bible. So for us, it's the five books of Moses, and then the books of prophets and writings. And so the makeup of what is the Jewish Bible for the five books of Moses, prophets and writings is not identical to Christianity. A lot of the books do overlap, and sometimes the order is a little switched up. That's a completely different conversation for a different day to be able to pick apart some of those differences and why, etc. But the big thing for Jews is that those five books, what you would call the Old Testament, is of utmost importance, and that is the foremost text. If I were to ask, and when I speak to a lot of groups, I say, if you want to know where something comes from, 99% of the time, the answer is going to be Torah. And when I say Torah, it's going to be those five books. Okay, and so when we use that, we take those five books and we turn it into ways that we are trying to create constant relevancy with our lives and bringing them meaning into our lives. And so we take the holidays, the calendar, rituals directly from Torah. And those are the things that create the Jewish calendar that we have throughout the year. So we are a couple weeks away from Passover, from Pesach. And so we know that the story of the Exodus obviously not only gets its own book, but gets a lot of time and many verses and chapters out of Torah. And so one of the most important pieces that we are taught in Torah, it says that we are told to continually tell the story over and over and over again. And because we have this, Bechol Dor Vador Chayav Adam Lirot Tzatzmo Ki Ilu Hu Yatzami Mitzrayim, that in every generation, you are to see yourself as if you personally came out of Egypt. And so we take that and we literally put that to task, and that is the basis for the Passover Seder that many, that you may or may not have seen or been to, that the first night or two of Passover, that families will gather around a table for the sole purpose of telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt. And over the last couple thousand years, we've added dozens and dozens of rituals to fill that in and to create this beautiful learning opportunity. And it all comes out of verses of Torah. We also pick up a calendar. So the Jewish calendar is what's called a solar luni calendar. So it is a mixture of solar, the sun, and luni, the lunar calendar. So our months are based entirely off of the lunar calendar of 28 days, etc. We also, the sun is very important in ours. And so I'll get into a little bit more about what that looks like. But we have a series of, basically the calendar was kind of sort of formulated in the time of Jews who were living in Babylonia. In Babylon, after the destruction of the first temple, they were sent into exile into Babylonia, into Babylon. And so they picked up a lot of the calendar from there. And that's kind of permeated through over the last couple thousand years. And so we have holidays. There is an adjustment that actually happens this year, but 7 out of 19 years, it's kind of hard to explain. There's a, instead of a leap days or leap hours, etc., we have, you know, a leap day, one day every 4 years in the Gregorian calendar. In the Jewish calendar, 7 out of 19 years, you add a whole extra month onto the calendar to make up for it. And because of how that cycles through, many of our that's what keeps our holidays at around the same time of the year. So in Islam, they don't have that extra leap month. And so that's how 1 year you can have Ramadan in August, and then a couple years later you have it in December. In Judaism, because of the leap system and how that gets factored into with sun cycles, etc., how that all works together, our holidays stay roughly within the same 6 week period every single year. Where am I in my notes? So let me give you two more examples of rabbinic concepts. So these are ideas of rabbis trying to make sense out of the Torah and how they get actualized into our daily life as Jews. So one example is, in talking about the calendar, our rabbis ask an important question of when does the day start? So typically, we all think of the day starts at midnight. Day starts and ends at midnight in the middle of the evening for us, middle of the night. That's where the name comes from. In the Jewish calendar, day starts at sundown. And the reason why it starts at sundown is because if you go back to Genesis 1, at the end of the first day of creation, it says, Vayerev, Vayivoker, Yom Echad. It was evening, it was morning, the first day. And because of the fact that that text says the evening comes first, that in Jewish tradition for 2,000 years, our days start at sundown. Which is why the Sabbath for us, Shabbat for us, starts Friday night at sundown and goes all the way through, and it ends Saturday at sundown. Does that make sense? Okay. It's okay for someone to say no. I'm happy to try to explain that better if that didn't make sense. I really am. So that's one example. So we have this idea of just very simply of when do you start a day going into, going back, and again, going back to Torah and seeing how Torah would push upon your decision or where you are and how you would do that. Second one that's a little more obtuse. So in Torah, we find the dietary laws. We find them. They're spread out in a couple different places. There's mainly one section, and in that section we find it says you should not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Now, and typically, kid is not like a child. Okay, a kid is like an actual like baby goat, but a baby goat in its mother's milk. Now, a very literal reading of this is, Rabbi, don't go and have baby goat with a side of goat's milk for dinner, because we understand how that could be construed as cruel, I think. Rabbinic law has this concept of what's called building a fence around the Torah, is the way that they put it. Building a fence around the Torah. And building a fence around the Torah means that you don't take an action to prevent yourself from putting yourself in a situation in which you would violate God's law. Okay, so sometimes rabbinic stringencies are to prevent yourself from even putting yourself in the situation of violating God's law. So, not boiling a kid in its mother's milk has turned into, over those first 1,000 years or so of the creation of this rabbinic Judaism post the destruction of the Second Temple, this idea that you don't mix meat and milk. Rabbi, chickens don't lactate. I understand that, but also, when you cook a chicken in the right way in a red sauce, you can't really, if you grind up chicken, you can't really tell ground up chicken from ground up turkey from ground up beef until after you've already eaten it. And if you don't know what it is until after you've already eaten it, then you could possibly violate God's law. So that's where kind of sort of see this string of thought, a very legalistic thought, the Talmud. There's a big reason why a lot of Jews end up with law degrees is because it's kind of it's not just a stereotype. I mean, it's also this idea that there's a lot of interplay between the legalistic thinking of the Talmud and modern law, and seeing Talmud, it's not officially a legal code in the strictest sense of it, but it has a lot of that same legal thinking. And so they help each other, that for many Jews who are studying Talmud, studying modern law is a simple concept because you've been doing it since you were a kid. And for those adults who are trying to learn Talmud who are already lawyers, they're like, oh, well, I learned this in law school. So it's a lot of that interplay of thinking. I'm going to two or three more big picture belief things that I will talk about that I think are kind of, to highlight a few things I would say are, especially knowing my crowd of being here at an Episcopal church, of some differences between Judaism and Christianity. So the first thing that I will say is that in Judaism, belief matters, but belief isn't everything. In fact, Judaism, learning and action are more important than belief. That yes, and you know, statistics back this up with sociology, that the majority of Jews do believe in God. Now you have to figure out what God they believe in. How do you define God with your own personal theology, and do you truly believe in the, you know, hyper masculine, hyper at times warlike, overbearing God of the Bible? Although that's not entirely true as well, because we have other moments of God in Bible of being a feminine, loving, caring God. But there's this idea that God is referred to as a he in our texts. Okay, so we have all these ideas. And so there is a very broad spectrum of theologies in Jewish life to figure that out. But so belief matters, but action is more important. And so in Jewish tradition, in Torah, in the five books of Moses, we find that there are 613 commandments, 613 mitzvot. And those 613 commandments, well, about 200 of them have to do with sacrifices at the temple, so we can't do those right now. So we're now down to somewhere around 400, give or take. Out of those 400, there are a lot of them that say are basically split up in the categories of things you can do and things you should do and things you shouldn't do. Okay? Don't murder. Great. One, check. Don't steal. Two, check. Okay, so we have a lot of those types of laws, and we also have things that turn into commandments, such as don't boil a kid in its mother's milk, so another don't, or love your neighbor as yourself. So there are things that are commandments that you should do and commandments that you shouldn't do, but so that number of 613 is the number that our tradition comes to. And out of those 613 commandments, I mean, those are the basis of of Jewish life. Those are the basis of Jewish life. And so those actions can outweigh most anything else. And so in terms of, I know one of the questions that Reverend Martin asked me to talk about was a little bit of afterlife and Judaism's belief and views of the afterlife. I'll get to that later, but that will kind of interplay with what I just said about belief and action. A second really important piece, at least in terms of differentiating Judaism from Christianity, Judaism does not believe the Messiah has come yet. That in Judaism, we are working, well, there are two main streams of thought in Judaism. Either you are working to create a messianic world, what's called the messianic era, a world that is filled with God's law and love and goodness, and that we are working towards that time when we are able to get there and live in that peaceful, wonderful, perfect world together. Or what I would say is the more traditional law that, or more traditional concept of, you are working and doing your best to create a good world that will be welcoming whenever God decides it's time for the Messiah to show up. So we very much believe the Messiah has not come yet. We are working towards, I believe in, I'm a big messianic era person, that I believe very much in, that it is my job to help make the world a better place, and in doing the work that I do and helping us all to live lives of meaning, lives of love, lives of goodness, lives of caring, that will create a perfect, beautiful, messianic world for all of us. Then the final thing that on this topic, is, so in Christianity, or many sects of Christianity, denominations of Christianity, there's the concept of original sin. Judaism very much rejects that concept. That in Judaism, and in fact, in response to the creation of the idea of original sin, we added a whole prayer about it, about how we don't believe in original sin. It's not the actual, the wording of the prayer. The prayer begins, Elohai neshama shenatata bi, so my God, the soul that you have put in me, Tahorahi, it is pure. That in Judaism, we believe that we are born pure. We also are born with free will, and we have the ability to do bad and evil things. And we all know that people do bad and evil things, unfortunately. And all of us have the capacity to do wrong. And all of us are, because we are human, will do wrong in our lives. Be the first one to stand up and say, I am not perfect, that I have done things wrong in my life. But that the idea in Judaism is that we very much believe that our souls are pure, that we believe in the positive ability of people to be good. And through us being good, that we are able to do good in our world. Just reading through, making sure I covered all my big notes. Okay. I'm going to jump a little bit into some of the different branches of Judaism. What comes with that is a history lesson. And I also know that my goal is to end in around 7 minutes. So talk for 2 minutes, show a video that will help a little bit, and then we'll move into some Q&A. So as I said, I kind of touched a little bit on the history of pre and post the destruction of the Second Temple. So there are really, in terms of Jewish history for what do Jews believe, I would say, there are three time periods. Some people believe we are on the cusp of moving into a fourth time period. That's a different conversation for a different day. The first time period is the Judaism of the Israelites, which is kind of anachronistic to say, but that's a different conversation just for the easier nomenclature for today. But the Judaism of the Israelites, our people did God's sacrifices as instructed in the five books, as instructed by Moses at the tabernacle and at the temple. The destruction of the Second Temple ended that period. And as a part of the destruction of the Second Temple, our people went into the diaspora, that our people have been spread out throughout the world. Jews have been living in Rome since the destruction of the Second Temple, since the Roman Empire came into power, actually a couple hundred years before the destruction of the Second Temple, because they had jobs like other people, and ended up in some Jews ended up in the merchant class and ended up on ships traveling all over the world. And so there has been pretty much a continually running Jewish community in Rome for 2,000 years. It's the longest continually inhabited Jewish community outside of Jerusalem in the land of Israel. And just like that, just like Rome, there are Jews who've been in other parts of the world ever since, that as the rise and fall of various empires went, so too did Jews go, just as a part of living there in those societies. And that as Jews spread out throughout the world in the diaspora, Jews have throughout time, and this is true and could pick that apart all the way from biblical times until today, have taken on parts of the societies that they are in and created some their own subcultures. Italian Jews will have very different rituals and customs than Polish Jews, than Spanish Jews, than Iraqi Jews, than Moroccan Jews. And today it looks obviously different as the Jewish populations of the world have shifted. Really, we kind of sort of see it as bipolar of we have the pole of American Jewry, which itself is complicated, and Jewry of Israel, really as being the two strong dominant forces in Jewish life today. Jews who live in other places in the world, unfortunately, kind of are an afterthought, only just due to their number. Not that there are lots of organizations that support them, and traveling and visiting them is wonderful, but really American in the Israeli Jewish communities are the two major things. So we had this whole middle section of the second period where Jews were kind of their own separate ethnic groups as a part of these wider societies. Then with the rise of nationalism after the Enlightenment in the last 400 years, as we've seen the rise and fall of nation states, and we are still obviously in a big nation state world, that Jews have created this, the modern different movements kind of come from the Enlightenment, and the response to the two main questions. So one is what's typically in scholarship called the Jewish question. So are Jews equal citizens of their society? And the Jews of France under Napoleon had different responses to that answer and that question. And the French people also had different responses than did the German Republic, than did Austro-Hungarian Empire, etc. Each nation state in each place, you have to ask the question of, are Jews equal citizens of society? And then the second question that kind of sparks off for the different branches is, if the answer to that first question is yes, do you as a Jew choose to exercise your citizenship? In what ways do you choose to integrate with society? In what ways do you choose to allow that culture to become a part of who you are and become a part of your own personal practice, if you will? And just one other, so the reason why I harp on the idea of the Jewish question is because it's not a coincidence that the Nazis called it the final solution. The Nazi idea to exterminate Jewry was called the final solution because it was the solution to the Jewish question. So are Jews equal citizens of our society? No, we must exterminate them. Obviously, the most extreme answer to that question. So, to clarify a couple things, I hope you kind of my highlights of the Jewish question. So, one of the big holdups in the creation of these different movements is, what language do you pray in, and what do your prayers say? So, removing Jerusalem from the prayer book. Yes, we feel at home here in America, and so we wouldn't pray, of course, for a rebuilt Jerusalem. This is what early Reformed Jews would have said. It was also in response to the typical trope of dual loyalty. If you believe that you can't be both Jewish and American or Jewish and French, well, then I, as a Jew, would have to decide what's more important to me. And so early Reformers removed prayers, particularly talking about rebuilding Jerusalem, or the concept of Aliyah, of moving to Israel, removing those from our liturgy and from our belief structures as a way of saying, oh, I'm American. I'm choosing the nation where I live because, honestly, because if you don't do that, there's a long history of persecution for not doing that. Jewish world is different today. A lot of these original beliefs that I, at least in the Jewish world, would call classical Reformed Judaism is the typical term that's used around them. A lot has changed. Did you notice I'm wearing a kippah, which a Reformed Jew 150 years ago would probably look at me and sound crazy for doing such a thing. That as some of those changes have continued to happen, when I spoke about moving into a fourth segment of Jewish life, there's really, we're starting to look at what's we're saying in scholarship in the Jewish world as a post-ethnic Judaism, where, yes, we have German Jewry and Reform and Conservative, but also partly because of the melting pots of America and of the melting pots in Israel of Jewish life, that someone whose grandparents are Moroccan Jews marries someone whose grandparents are Polish Jews, and then what does your family customs and traditions look like? And we're kind of sort of seeing a melding between all these different ideas and concepts. When looking at the different movements, there are going to be two major points that they're going to talk about. One of them is how much will you accept modernity into your life and practice? We kind of saw that in Reform Orthodoxy with Conservative kind of somewhere in the middle. And it just kind of depends on where you are, and no two Reform congregations are alike in that regard. And then finally, the other thing that they touched on a little bit is the authorship of Torah. So a traditional interpretation would be Moses wrote Torah at Sinai through God's wisdom and was passed down continually into the oral Torah, which is the Talmud. And that rabbinic law is, there's a what's called the chain of tradition, the Shalshelet de Kabbalah, that has been continuing ever since. And you see yourself as a direct link in that chain that sees yourself beholden to that entire chain. That's what you're going to find in Orthodoxy. In the Reform movement and in Conservative movement, but in liberal Judaism, you'll often find concept of the Torah being divinely inspired by authors and not so much directly written by Moses. That creates some different ability to do things differently theologically. And the last thing that I'll say is that, I just left my brain. I have about 5 minutes for Q&A, so let's take a couple of questions, and when I think of that final thing, I will come back to it and end on that beautifully pertinent and powerful moment.
Good for you.
Yes.
So how was it determined, the rabbi's selection or the process?
To become a rabbi?
Just in the beginning. But when they made the change, they say, now we're going to...
Oh, great. So there's would say, at least in Judaism, a famous story of one of the first rabbis who had himself by some of his students put himself in a coffin, was carried out of Jerusalem during the siege, and went to the general of the Roman army and said, "Can I continue doing my Jewish thing over here on the side in the city of Yavna? I won't cause a problem. I just want to keep doing my religion on a small thing. I won't be one of the zealots who caused the uprising that caused this war." And so the idea of who are these rabbis, they were just the learned people who were this group of people who at that point in time were kind of sort of self-ordained. I mean, rabbi literally just means teacher. So they were the ones who were teaching, who were at the forefront of the thinking. Now it's an ordination process that looks a lot like clergy in Christianity and in other faiths. It's very much a lineage, but just in terms of it's not a biological lineage. Great.
Hey, first, thanks so much for coming.
This of course.
Terrific, and really appreciate it. I think all of us are so interested, and I know it's hard to kind of capture it all in 30 minutes, but I've got a couple of questions. First, is Jesus considered a prophet in either the Reformist or Orthodoxy, and has the Jewish religion gone to see if he checks all the boxes or some of the boxes, and he checks some of them, but we don't think he checks that box or that box, therefore he can't be a prophet or perhaps...
Great. So Judaism would not consider Jesus to be a prophet. Jesus was born a Jew and died a Jew. Depending upon who you are depends on how good of a Jew he was. So Jews love to say that we're bad Jews. We love to say that we're like not in it, which is like a really interesting phenomenon of our own faith. Jesus, so in as I talked about these different movements and different ideas, so even in the times of the temple, there was not one way of thinking. There were different groups, Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes, and Zealots. And people like to argue as to how people fit in. Typically, Jesus was considered to be a Pharisee, which is a would have been one of the major groups of thinking in the Second Temple period. Really, Jesus as a prophet, my understanding, again, who am I to teach Christianity in a church, but is really came in the first few decades after his death with his students. But in terms of Jewish thought and belief, he's not a prophet. Yeah, Chris. No, so that's great. So there's another video from this wonderful company that I get to. So not all, and that bell means it's my time at 8 o'clock, and I know that some of you have to leave right now. So I'll answer this question and wrap up, and then I have about 15, 20 minutes. I can stick around if people have more questions if you'd like to ask them. So not all, when we say orthodoxy is a big giant term used for lots of different people from lots of different segments with lots of different beliefs. Inside of orthodoxy, there are dozens and dozens of smaller groups and that have a lot of that ethnic flavor to it, that if you are from Lithuania, you will have different understandings and ideas, and sometimes your liturgy might look different or whatever that is, than Jews from Morocco who are Orthodox. Some of them are Hasidic, and some of them are, there's a counter movement called Misnagdim, and the other Hebrew terms. And so it's really complicated. And so even in these big broad brushstrokes, so I'm a Reformed Jew. So I work at Congregation Beth Israel, which is a large synagogue in Southwest Houston. There's Congregation Emmanuel, which is a large Reformed synagogue right next to Rice University. And we have a lot of the same basic belief structures, but our synagogues and our communities look different. It's because you create your own culture. Just like this church, if you were to go to a different Episcopalian church that's either, you know, smaller or just a different location, will have its own different flavor to it. And so that's really the same thing in Orthodoxy. Thank you for that question. I want to thank you all so much for being here this morning and for giving me the opportunity to teach a little bit. I know that, Larry, you hit the nose on the, hit it right on the head. It's like you have a half an hour to teach of your religion. Ready, set, go. And so I'm just really grateful that all of you to be able to listen. And again, first of all, I hope you have a wonderful day and have a blessed day filled with health and happiness, and hope that it is a day filled with meaning for all of you as you go out. And if you have other questions, I'm happy to stick around for another 15 minutes or so to answer questions. Thank you.